So thank you so much, Norman, for allowing us to come visit you today in your apartment. It's such a pleasure to be here to speak with you. I'm hoping that we can explore a few things to do with the politics of memory and how that's being exploited by certain actors, Germany being one, to stifle pro-Palestinian voices, and also how we can still genuinely honor the memory of the Holocaust while being in solidarity with pro-Palestinian efforts. But before engaging in those questions in earnest, I'd just like to ask you, out of curiosity mainly, because your approach as a thinker and as an activist involves so much rigor and nuance, if you can just give us a little bit of an idea of what your upbringing was like that connects with that.
My parents were refugees from Europe. They came over after the war. They were literate. I would say my mother was hyper literate. She attended a good school. She got a classical education. She knew Latin. She knew French. She knew classical music. She was apparently quite good at math. When the war was verging, she was enrolled in the mathematics faculty at Warsaw University, which I assume was unusual because she was a woman and she was Jewish. So for those, despite those two obstacles, she was enrolled in the mathematics faculty. After the war, my father was a vocational worker. He was a factory worker. I have to say, I didn't have that much contact with my father because it was an era in which factory workers got up early. It was before alarm clocks. Alarm clock was a luxury. You just had an internal alarm clock. And he got up promptly at 6 a.m. I'm sure not much different than a serf or a peasant in middle Europe. They didn't have a contraption called an alarm clock. And he went to work. He worked 6 days a week, to be precise, 5 and a half. He worked on Saturdays until 2 o'clock. And the remainder of the time at home, he was sleeping. It was not an easy life. My father. My mother, she had to raise three children on her own. That may not sound like a big task for your listeners, but when I say on her own, I mean that literally, because every single member of her family before the war and every single member of my father's family before the war was exterminated. So she couldn't turn to a sister to help out, her parents to help out, and she didn't trust anybody. There was no way she would ever have a babysitter. So she was, as they say, a hands-on mother, which meant very little time for my father or for my mother for intellectual activity. However, they read the New York Times, which was the newspaper of record back then. They read it religiously. They read every page. That was a family ritual. The Sunday New York Times came in a large number of sections. There was the magazine section, the book review section, the arts section, of course, the business section, and the two news sections. It was a very thick paper, very thick. And I remember at Sunday morning, oh, there was also the sports section. And on Sunday morning at breakfast, we would divide up which section are you going to get. Oh, and there was also the news of the week in review section, because you had to read as a kid. Let's say in history class in 10th grade, Mrs. Gerstenhaber, we would get quizzes on the news of the week in review. You have to read it for school. but we read it as a family. So even as there wasn't time for intellectual activity, given the burdens of my father's work and my mother's work at home, there wasn't time. Still, it's a Jewish family, and the life of the mind was a premium was attached to the life of the mind. Nobody had to tell us to do well in school. Nobody had to order us to do well in school. You just knew you had to do well in school. It just went with the, it was just part of a Jewish cultural milieu. It was, I grew up in a highly, highly competitive and ambitious neighborhood. And competition and ambition, I gave my all.
I just want to say as an aside, I feel these interviews that I'm doing are, they're kind of a gift from the interviewee, because you've done so much, and to your credit, you're mobilizing people.
I look, the last 6 months have been brutal for me. I'm not a young man, and I did not expect this to happen at all. I had given up on Gaza in 2020. I had chronicled it for 15 years. I gave 42 years of my life to the Israel-Palestine conflict. That's all I did. That's all I did. Read and reread and reread and reread these human rights reports, because I basically consider myself a forensic scholar. Forensic means I try to analyze the evidence, in particular the evidence that Israel brings forth, and try to show why it's not true, why it's false. And it's never blatantly false, or sometimes it's blatantly false, but most of the time it's not. And it requires a huge amount of concentration to read it and reread it and reread it, to find the errors in the logic, the errors in the alleged evidence, the juxtaposition between what was said on page 3, what was said on page 30, and what was said on page 300. You know, and but you have to keep rereading it and rereading it to see, wait, but they said that on page 3, but they also said that on page, you know. So I did that for 42 years. As a matter of fact, I'll just get up for 1/2 second. How did I start out? Oh, excuse me. Did I drop something?
Yeah, no problem.
No problem. Okay. So, how did I start out in this whole thing? I was a follower of Mao Zedong, a Maoist, in the 1970s. And I was a fanatic. I was a true believer. I also still maintained my intellectual self-respect. And there were people of very high intellectual caliber. Paul Sweezy, my professor and friend, Charles Bettelheim. These were people of a very high intellectual order who were also Maoists, and I read them. I studied under them. That proved I suffered from many illusions, and those illusions were shattered. They were pulverized when Mao Zedong passed, and everything was turned upside down shortly after his passing. And then in 1982, so I was shattered when that happened. I felt, it wasn't just that I was wrong, it was I felt like a fool. I had dismissed everybody who disagreed with me in the language of the day as being a bourgeois or a petty bourgeois. That's the language we used. And it turned out they were right. And I was very arrogant, very cocky, very sure of myself. I did read a lot, but I didn't read the other side. I read my side. And so I was completely sure. I was bedridden for 3 weeks. As I said, not so much from being wrong, but being humiliated. So in June 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon. I was always a political activist. Israel and Palestine weren't on my radar at all, not at all. Then Israel invades Lebanon. I got involved as an activist. And then, for reasons not worth going into, I decided, hey, this is a subject for a doctoral dissertation. And even though I'd finished my coursework at Princeton, I hadn't yet written the dissertation. So I figured, what the hell? I'll write my doctoral dissertation on the subject, as I chose the subject of Zionism. That was my doctoral dissertation was a study of the theory of Zionism. And just as I was finishing up the dissertation in 1982 or 83, just as I was finishing it up, I start reading about this book called From Time Immemorial. This is the book. And this book claims that it's going to revolutionize our understanding of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and everything that we thought about it was wrong. And it said the claim was that the author proves through this rigorous demographic study Palestine was empty on the eve of Zionist colonization. The Zionists came to Palestine, made the desert bloom, and then all these Arabs from neighboring countries surreptitiously enter Palestine and claim to be indigenous to the land. Okay, a lot of people on what you might call the pro-Palestine, I don't like that term, on the pro-Palestine community dismissed this, oh, this is just Zionist garbage, you know. I wasn't ready to do that. Why? Because not too long ago, I had dismissed everybody who was didn't share my views of China as being a bourgeois or petty bourgeois. And now I'm hearing, oh, that's just Zionist this and Zionist that. And I thought, no, once bitten, twice shy. I'm not going to make that mistake again of just dismissing what I didn't agree with. And so I sat down. I was working at that point in a settlement house with kids, poor kids from projects, what we call projects in the city. And I used to work on my dissertation in the morning, work at the settlement house in the afternoon, and then go home and do work on my dissertation at night. And then with this book, I decided I'm not making that mistake again. And I start to read the book and read the book and read the book and read the book. I've got to know whether what she's saying is true. Because if it's true, I'm out of here. I'm not going to support what's not true. So if this is the truth, then the cause is fake, a fake, I'm out. And so the book had at the end these tables, as you could see. I didn't use calculators or anything back then. I just used paper and pencil. And I'm going over it and over it and over it. And one night, it was like 1 a.m., I suddenly discovered that the demographic data was faked. I can't tell you, it's so long ago now, it's almost a half century ago. My heart started to palpitate and I broke out into a sweat. I lived in a small studio apartment. I started to pace it back and forth, pace it back and forth. And I kept saying, I did it. I did it. I proved the book is a fraud. And without going into all the other details, that's how I began a career as a forensic scholar. And I did that for 42 years. And Then in 2020, I decided it's over. They lost, the cause is lost. And I had given up on Gaza. Even my last books on the topic, the last two were these two. This was Gaza, an inquest into its martyrdom. And at the very end of the book, the very end, I say, if I can find it, the author holds out faint hope that this book will find an audience among his contemporaries. Still, the truth should be preserved. It is the least that's owed the victims. Perhaps one day in the remote future, when the tenor of the times is more receptive, someone will stumble across this book, collecting dust on a library shelf, blow off the cobwebs, and be stung by outrage at the lot of a people, the people of Gaza, if not forsaken by God, then betrayed by the cupidity and corruption, careerism and cynicism, cravenness and cowardice of mortal men. So, I didn't think anyone would read the book. I didn't. When the case came before the International Criminal Court, for not the ICJ, not the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, I wrote this long, simply dissection of the evidence presented by Israel in order to help out in the criminal court proceeding. The book, as my publisher lamented, sold about 350 copies, most of which were purchased by me to give to people at The Hague for the case. And that was it. Nobody read it. 350 copies sold, half of them I purchased, which means a huge amount of work. Huge amount of work. About 100 people may have read it. You know, I gave up. So when October 7th happened, I had already moved on to other subjects, but I was physically tired. You know, I'll be honest, physically depleted. I'll be honest about it. So I wasn't ready. No one was the first thing I had to do.
You bring this forensic scholarship approach also, as I was starting off with at the beginning, to memory and the politics of memory. And I'm wondering, how did you get involved in that? When was the first time you got involved with the forensic approach to the politics of memory and looking at how various states, whether it's Israel or Germany, weaponized memory for nefarious purposes?
Well, the only book of mine that ever sold was The Holocaust Industry. That was a complete fluke. You know, it's funny, the genesis of these things. There was a book written by a University of Chicago professor named Peter Novick. It was called The Holocaust in American Life. Now, one thing I knew about from life experience was the Holocaust and American life, because my parents were authentic survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. They came here as refugees. When we were growing up, they were scornfully referred to as greenhorns. Greenhorn meant that you don't know the ways of the United States, because a lot of the Jews that we came in contact with, they came over, their families came over, in the great wave of Jewish immigration at the turn of the 20th century. Okay, so they grew up in the Jewish ghettos in New York, places like Brownsville and so forth, and they were already they were second or third generation already. So they knew how to be an American. And my parents were greenhorns. They were not yet assimilated to American life. So they come over, and I knew exactly what the experience of Jews who survived the Nazi Holocaust, what was their experience in the United States? It was my parents. So when I read the book, The Holocaust in American Life, there were parts I agreed with, parts I didn't agree with, and I was pretty confident about my judgments. But there were some things I strongly disagreed with. So my publisher at the time, very small little publishing house called Verso, the head of the Verso at the time is a fellow named Colin Robinson. And Colin Robinson, whatever conversation you're having, whatever conversation, you can be talking about, oh, it's going to be a nice day out tomorrow. And he says, why don't you write a book about it? That's he always, whenever you say, he says, why don't you write a book about it? So he says, why don't you write a book about the Nelnik Holocaust in American Life? So I sat down. I first wrote a review of the book for the London Review of Books. It was the last time they ever had me in their ranks. And then I said, okay, I'll turn it into a book. And it did have an impact. It became an international bestseller. It's very hard to calculate how many copies a book sells because a lot of countries don't have copyright laws. And so pirated editions. And so a large part of the Middle East where the book was popular for reasons which are fairly obvious. There all these pirated editions came out. Of course, one of my dreads is how it was translated and whether they were faithful to the precision of my language, or it became the Jews invented the Holocaust, which wasn't the point of the book, actually. I had also, before the Holocaust industry, I had written another book on the, not with not myself, myself and a German historian, Ruth Bettina Byrne. We wrote a book on this book by a fellow who's long been forgotten, named Daniel Jonah Goldhagen. It was called Hitler's Willing Executioners, which was a huge international event, the publication of that book. I thought the book was garbage. And I sat down and I dissected it. I think I produced a competent piece of forensic scholarship. And then with the After that came the Holocaust industry, where I got involved again in the question of the Nazi Holocaust, not as a historical event about which I never felt I had the competence to comment on, but as an ideological event, namely how the Nazi Holocaust had been instrumentalized in order to both shield Israel from criticism, and also at that point it was being used as a blackmail weapon against various European countries, starting with Switzerland. And there, obviously, the efficacy of the Holocaust weapon has over time been seriously diminished because of overuse. So I don't think it's nearly as effective now as it was then, with obviously the exception of Germany itself, where it's used to used to intimidate Germany into doing things which they have to know are wrong. But I will grant this, I think Germany is in a morally a very difficult situation because it is very hard for them to criticize Israel because of that historical baggage. I get that. I'm not going to deny it. I just wish, and I don't want to sound vulgar, I just wish they would shut up. They know what they're doing is wrong. Why do you have to do it in such a flagrant, such an outrageous way? You could just say, for historical reasons, we feel uncomfortable criticizing Israel. We'll simply defer to the consensus opinion of the EU. Okay? That to me would be a reasonable position. But to defend what's going on now, until about 3 weeks ago, unconditionally, unacceptable. If I were in Germany and I saw the chancellor, I would spit in his face. No. No. Unacceptable. I understand the moral dilemma. I get that. But with the exception of Germany, I would say the Holocaust weapon hasn't been particularly effective in recent years now in the Democratic Party, because the mantle of the Democratic Party became identity politics. At its base, like the Black Lives Matter movement, and all kindred movements like that, they had adopted Palestine as a cause. It's true. And then when October 7th happened, and thereafter, the genocide in Gaza, that base now was energized by Palestine, because already they were supportive of the cause, and that created the big split in the party now, where the leadership doesn't know what to do. The Biden, Schumer, before Nancy Pelosi, that leadership doesn't know what to do, because it created this monster. Namely, it invested in the identity politics, and now the identity politics is saying, well, Israel too was a settler colonial state. That was part of identity politics. Israel is oppressing the Palestinian identity, you know. And so, in a way, the identity politics backfired on the Democratic Party because the leadership is deeply entrenched, both ideologically and financially. It's deeply entrenched in supporting Israel. But the base of the Democratic Party, because it was created on the ideology of identity politics, the base is totally committed to Palestine. And so, as I said, it backfired on the party because the base had identif had I had appropriate Palestine as its cause.
Actually, you frame it so well because, yes, there's the identity politics at the grassroots level and then also at that elite level.
And the elite level never adopted Palestine.
Because they seem to have been so, for years, so progressive. I even remember the moment I came back from graduate school, just going through some of the Canadian newspapers, and I was thinking, since when have you become, has the establishment become so, am I supposed to feel happy? I guess so.
Because.
The, like, when did you become invested in social justice? Like, I don't
Well,
remember
because it
that.
was a fake social justice. It was social justice without class.
Right.
But what happened was they didn't really care whether the base was pro-Palestine because the cause seemed dead. And
Interesting.
so all these activists are for BDS. Nobody cared because right now, what was the only thing? There were no negotiations going on. There was no peace process anymore. The whole thing was over. And then on October 7th, it wasn't over. And they were in a huge, not were, every day. It's evident that the Biden administration is in a huge mess because just today, if you don't mind, I
Of
was
course,
just
yes.
today. So if we go to how Gaza protesters are challenging Democratic leaders, the top story in the Times. The whole base, because of the identity politics, that's the irony. The whole base, because of the identity politics, is in revolt against the leadership. And the leadership created the identity politics in order to get a base to replace the white working class. It was an irony. It was an irony. I mean, people said to me, you have to admit, Norm, for all of your criticism of identity politics, you have to admit they did put Palestine on the map, which is true. It's true. My credo in life is never quarrel with facts. That's factually true. You have to explain it. The facts. You can't ignore them. And I think the explanation is the whole thing backfired because they thought the cause was dead, so they didn't care. Ah, let them shout BDS, who cares? You know, it's been, as Zbigniew Brzezinski famously said during, he was the national security advisor to Carter at one point in the eternal peace process, he says it's bye-bye PLO. Was his famous line, bye-bye PLO, meaning the representative Palestinian organization at the time, the Palestine Liberation Organization. And it looked like it was bye-bye Palestine. Remember, before October 7th, what was everybody talking about? The Abraham Accords, Saudi Arabia joining with Israel and the United States in the defense and a defense pact. And there was no talk about the Palestinians. So the whole thing backfired because suddenly the Palestine cause sprung to life again. And it had become one of the litmus tests of the identity politics movement. Though it seemed at before October 7th, it seemed like an irrelevancy. So it was, as I said, in this case, it really was complicated what happened. It requires a fine analysis.
So just before we wrap up, Norman, I wanted to ask you because you've, to your credit, so consistently been able to exercise a certain degree of equanimity in the face of a great deal of opposition throughout your academic career and as an activist. And I wonder if you have any advice for young academics or journalists or activists who might be experiencing similar.
The advice is very simple. There was a philosopher, his name was Julian Bender, and he wrote a little book. It's called in French La Trahison des Clercs, or The Treason of the Intellectuals. I'm going to get it because it's on my shelf. Oops, just give me one moment. It's going to be right up here because it's arranged in alphabetical order. So it's a little book, The Treason of the Intellectuals. It's a complex book, but the one of his core theses, not all, but one is there are basically two sets of values in the world. One are material values. Everybody knows them. Fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, power and privilege. Fame and fortune, power and privilege. It's what 99% of humanity strives for. You want a little recognition in life, a little fame. What Andy Warhol famously called the 15 minutes of fame. Everybody wants their 15 minutes of self-recognition. And everybody wants a little money, a little privilege. You want the power, you want the privilege, you want the fame, the 15 minutes of fame, and you want some fortune. That's what 99% of people strive towards. And Benda calls that the real world values, the material values of the material world. And then he says, on the other hand, there's a tiny fraction of people who strive for spiritual values. And the spiritual values, everybody knows. The cameraman knows. The cameraman's assistant knows. The sound man knows. It's called truth and justice. Okay? So here we have fame and fortune, and here we have truth and justice. And Benda says, those two sets of values always come into conflict. There's a fundamental contradiction between the two. The more fame you have, the more fortune you have, the less truth is there is in your life, and the less justice there is in your life. If you want to stay faithful to those values of your youth, the values of truth and justice, the idealistic values, we call young people who embrace those values, we call them idealistic, which is true, because what's the opposite of idealistic? Materialistic. And it's Benda's spiritual material, idealistic, materialistic, okay? So don't expect reward. It comes with the turf. I'm at the end of my life. I made decisions at a very young age, relatively young age, I would say around 15. It was clear to me the path I would carve out in life, the trajectory I would take. I don't think it would be fair to say I've deviated from it. What I set out to do, I did. I've been bitter. I've been angry. I've been furious at what I felt to be were betrayals of me personally by people I counted as friends and comrades. Only thing I regret at this particular moment is I don't have the mental energy or the physical wherewithal to rise to the present occasion. I do my best. It's the best that I can do. But at this particular moment, I feel it's inadequate to the task at hand, which is the horrors that are being inflicted on those God-forsaken people, half of whom are children.
Thank you so much, Norman, for this deeply insightful and thought-provoking conversation, and very moving as well for myself. Just wondering if there's any final observations and thoughts.
No. Okay. I think I've said what should be said at this particular moment.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. It's wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you.